This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. This is The Morning Run, and you're with me, Melissa Idris, and Sharad Kutan. Hello, and welcome back, Sharad, from the long weekend.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. And you too. Did you get some rest?
What was Christmas like for you? It was very festive. It was my birthday over the weekend. So.
Oh, was it? Yes. Oh, happy birthday. Belated.
Thank you.
You're a Christmas baby.
I am a Christmas baby. So lots of celebration, lots of food, and lots of family. And that's a potent combination, shall we say.
It is. Yeah, I can see your smile there, you know, sort of cracking on the corners. I spent my Christmas day by the Angsa Forest Reserve in Negeri Sembilan, where my aunt has a farm. And it's really quite beautiful, except I did something really silly and I decided to go exploring the more jungly areas of the farm. I've come back with one leech, very itchy leech bite, 1,000 cuts by, you know, all kinds of tropical plants. They all seem to have thorns or blades.
Did you see the leech on you? I'm sorry.
No, okay, you just
felt it.
No, you know, the thing about leeches is that they're almost invisible to the eye. They're these little black strands that kind of jump about. And then once they attach themselves to you, you don't really feel it because they have whatever it is when they bite into you, you don't really feel it. And then they have this anticoagulant thing that, you know, allows them to drink your blood. And then when they're fat and sated, they drop off.
Right.
And then all you're left with is a bleeding wound that won't stop bleeding.
Oh,
and then when it does stop bleeding, it itches quite a bit for quite a long time.
Well, you can tell I'm a city girl.
Yeah,
clearly.
So
okay,
I was very silly.
That's fun.
Yes, exploring the tropical jungles has its risks.
Well, I bet everyone's still in the holiday mood this week, and I guess, you know, the short work week again is not going to be helping any. We're going to be still working hard for you right here on The Morning Run, though. We've got lots of shows and interviews and programs scheduled.
I think a lot of people welcome the short week, don't they? I mean,
that's true. I think a lot of people are away as well because, you know, traditionally the last week is
you're kind of clearing leave and
lots of celebrations. Yeah.
And also, a lot of people are looking forward to the 3-day week next weekend because the next weekend is the 30th. It'll be the 31st, first and second. So Monday is a holiday, isn't it?
Yes. So again, a short work week. This one
and
next week
one
as well.
And, you know, it's my birthday next weekend.
I know, that's right.
So there we are. We're kind of festive babies, aren't we?
We are. Year-end babies. But I feel like that our birthdays are overshadowed by the big celebrations. As growing up, I would only get a birthday / Christmas present. I only get two. So I felt cheated out of one present.
Well, you know, you should count yourself lucky as a Muslim.
That's true. That's true.
But I must admit, as somebody coming from a Christian family, I too had suffered the same fate.
Which is you would only get like birthday
the Christmas/birthday present. Everybody was exhausted by the time.
But the good thing for you is that everyone's around to celebrate New Year's and they can go, happy birthday, Sharad, one shot. You know what I mean?
Not that they would remember.
Okay.
But actually, I'm not born on the 1st of January.
On the 2nd.
I'm born on the 2nd.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we'll wish Sharad happy birthday next week. It is a public holiday, isn't it? On your birthday.
It is. Yeah. Because, you know, the whole nation ought to celebrate when I celebrate.
That's right. I have to agree.
Whether they know it or not, they're celebrating my birthday.
Well, today on the show, on The Morning Run, we've got a great lineup for you. In fact, throughout this week on The Breakfast Grill, we're going to be looking at some of the major themes that have emerged in 2016. Today's show will be focusing on fintech. So 2016 saw Malaysia explore new frontiers in fintech, new innovative ways to disrupt traditional finance business models. In fact, I believe it was a speech by the newly minted governor this year. He had done quite a fair bit. I think in his very first speech, he said, he talked about how fintech is challenging the status quo of the financial industry. And we're looking at delivery channels that will challenge existing norms, transaction costs to be lowered, new business models that will emerge. So lots to discuss today. Ibrahim Sani will be doing a wrap of all the fintech companies we spoke to on The Breakfast Grill this year.
I think also what was interesting about Bank Negara's position was that it was going to give fintech companies the space to grow and play. And I think there was even an expression used.
A regulatory sandbox.
Which is suggests kind of a space to play, a safe space to play, right?
A literal sandbox.
Well, not a literal, quite, figurative.
A regulatory sandbox that will enable, I guess, experimentation of fintech solutions in a live environment, but then at the same time, mitigating any risks or should any fallout happen. So some safeguards there. Really quite interesting times for fintech. So we'll be recapping the year that was in terms of fintech companies on the Breakfast Grill. After the grill on current affairs, the impeachment of South Korean President Park Geun-hye, that's the focus of the show today. Earlier this month, of course, we saw millions of people hit the streets of Seoul demanding that President Park Geun-hye step down following a corruption scandal involving her longtime friend Choi Soon-sil. Now, quite interesting times. Whether or not this will change the dynamics of the politics in South Korea is something we're going to be exploring with Scott Seaman, a senior analyst at Eurasia Group.
Okay, I look forward to that. I think that sounds like it's going to be a very interesting and informative discussion.
Okay, 9:35 a.m. on the BBC World Service, DIY Tech. So this week's show will meet people who are taking technology into their own hands. We're going to be hearing from people, for instance, men who are 3D printing prosthetic limbs in garages, a family who has created their own smart home, and also a woman who has set up her own broadband in a rural area. So taking whatever tech you have and making it serve your needs in your community.
You know, I was reading over the weekend like a little park in China where the bridge over a little stream had been 3D printed. And yeah, so, you know, the thing is, anything, as it were, can be 3D printed. I think it's really dependent on the material you use, right? Because what the 3D printer can, I guess, process a number of things, plastics or whatever, maybe chocolate. You could put like chocolate in the mix and you could 3D print, you know,
whatever,
chocolate
yeah,
house.
Yeah.
But the point really is, you know, all these things, it's an extraordinarily, you know, flexible kind of technology and seems to be you'd be able to put it to all kinds of uses. But I'm not quite sure. I mean, I think with prosthetic limbs, there are probably a lot of considerations. I have watched a documentary about 3D printing prosthetic limbs. You know, again, it's a question of the quality of the material.
But that's good, I guess, because, you know, the prosthetic limbs, if you 3D print something, you could have it tailor-made to each person and, you know, I guess, however that person wants to live, right? So it's a different, I guess it's different from it being mass produced or having it custom made, which could be quite expensive. Bringing the cost down also is massive in 3D printing.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And it seems like it's almost affordable for anybody to buy a 3D printer. I know of at least one person who does.
I mean,
he happens to be an architect. But
To make models and the like?
Yeah, and anything. You know, I think you could just play around and, you know, create all kinds of things. But it also requires quite a bit of patience because it takes some time to, you know, create things.
It's the way of the future, Sharad. We might be 3D printing all sorts of things in the future. We could have our own 3D printers at home, and then, you know, I could change
you
up
could.
Accessories
no, in fact, you
every
can.
Day.
You can, yes.
New earrings, just 3D print them on the
I
way to
see
work.
See where your obsession goes. Yeah,
it's clearly heading that way. Okay, well, that's on the BBC World Service, DIY Tech. And we're also going to be exploring security concerns over the Internet of Things. But it's coming up to 10 minutes past 6 o'clock. Let's take a look at the news over the weekend. Of course, everyone talking about the death of pop superstar George Michael, tributes pouring in from around the world, and I think it caps the holiday, the Christmas holidays, as one. This is actually one of the most tragic years when it comes to people we've lost from the music world.
Yeah, and we have a short list of the individuals, and I don't think this is, in fact, is exhaustive. I think it just represents those who are
many, many more
mainstream musical artists, mm-hmm. and those in sort of in the pop world. So David Bowie, Glenn Frey, Maurice White of Earth, Wind and Fire, Prince, of course, huge loss, I think, for people of my generation, and then Leonard Cohen. Mm. I just read a wonderful piece, sort of a long interview with Leonard Cohen in The New Yorker, probably just months before he passed away, getting a sense of the really complex nature of that man and the musical genius he represented. But because people... And I think it's true with when it comes to musical tastes, Melissa, it's like people might mourn Michael Jackson or David Bowie, but it really depends on their musical taste. If they didn't like their music, then I don't think they would probably feel aggrieved.
But George Michael, for instance, I mean, he was pop enough, mainstream enough that almost every person you spoke to would at least know of Careless Whisper or Wake Me Up When You Go Go or Last Christmas. Sorry, I'm just going to rattle off.
But it's a generational thing, right? So, I mean, obviously for somebody like myself, grew up in the 80s, you know, George Michael's huge.
I'm sure the young ones know George Michael too. I mean, that's...
I don't think they even know Britney Spears.
Careless Whisper is kind of timeless, I have to admit. You know, it's kind of timeless.
Well, maybe you are an exception for your generation, Melissa, but I'm not sure. But if you're from the younger set, as it were, and you feel George Michael's loss, please tweet us at BFM Radio and tell us what you think George Michael contributed to the musical world.
Well, yesterday, Sony Music's Twitter account was hacked, and it was, I guess there were fake statements going viral on Twitter that Britney Spears had died. So just didn't...
Oh, really?
So following George Michael's actual passing.
Who would want to wish such...
Well, such I saw the hashtag Rest in Peace Britney trending on Twitter.
That might be
yesterday.
A reference to her music. Well, George Michael, on the other hand, you know, I mean, died too young. I mean...
53.
Leonard Cohen was in his 80s. I mean, he had a long and very rich life. Prince died far too young.
57?
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know about the others. Maurice White, how old was he?
Maurice White was 74, and he died after suffering from Parkinson's disease for years.
All right.
Yeah.
So maybe... sort of a blessing in disguise. But, you know, George Michael certainly, you know...
We still don't know the cause of the death.
I think reports are suggesting he had a heart attack, but what the heart attack was due to is unclear, you know, whether he had...
So the statement was that
heart problem, or
he passed away peacefully at home, but on cardiac arrest.
Yeah, he's been dogged by rumors of drug abuse and stuff like that. So I think he hasn't been, you know, necessarily a happy person. Mm. Though I believe he did have a long-term partner, an art dealer, I think by the name of Lenny Goss.
Okay.
So,
right.
And of course, George Michael also, you know, supported a lot of causes. He made some anti-war music, and of course, he also stood up for the LGBT community. And he himself came out, I think, in the late 90s.
Well, later in his life, I think in his late 20s. Let's take a look at news back home, Sherrod. Over the weekend, news of the bus accident in Moa dominated headlines. 14 people killed. Now, coming out of that, there have been proposals for mandatory seat belts and a ban on night travel. I don't know how much these preemptive measures, the proposals for preemptive measures, could come about, because if you remember, we started the year with that bus crash involving 10 vehicles. Do you remember that?
Yeah, you know, honestly, bus crashes are almost a dime a dozen now, and I think the question of these ideas that are floated every time you have a bus crash, it seems to suggest that, in fact, there is very little political will to deal with the problem.
Right.
I believe the bus driver had only 3 hours of sleep. Now, so that's got to do with also the company, right? Why would you put somebody on a shift or a rotation that, you know, made them work without sufficient sleep?
But I guess it's compounded, right? It's all these these factors. It's a holiday season, more people traveling. Again, probably.
But would you do that for a plane? I mean, would you send slack
again
on
security? So
this security?
Is coming back to the political will, Sharad, because with a plane, you've got the people who travel on planes generally tend to be a bit more, shall we say, of the higher income bracket. Yeah, wealthier people. And clearly, sometimes, I think Sharizan Johan tweeted over the weekend, and the tweet stuck with me. In reality, there is no political will to resolve this problem because those who take the express buses are not VIPs. These are for the lower income bracket people.
Well, so yeah, and Sharizan Johan is a constitutional lawyer and well-known for his work in that area. And I think he's absolutely right. I mean, it just seems you'll have these things said. You'll have front pages like the NST this morning, pay drivers more.
Drivers more. Do you think that will resolve the problem? So again, even if you have installation of seat belts for passengers, in speaking to some of the stakeholders with SPAD and all the bus associations, they say, well, we can install seat belts, but will the passengers keep the seat belts on throughout the entire journey? Now, we see in airplanes with the lights go on and you actually follow them. And so the seatbelt lights goes on and you buckle up because the pilot has told you to do so. And would you remain buckled up and seated in a bus ride?
Well, I think more so in a bus ride than a plane because there's nowhere to go in a bus. But there's
people,
no attendance to make sure that you do.
Exactly. There's no enforcement to make sure you do. Yeah.
And I think perhaps, you know, there's always a question of public awareness and education that needs to go along.
I don't think you can make the comparison of a plane versus a bus. You know, you can't say, oh, a pilot can't fly in 3 hours of sleep, whereas this bus driver is driving in 3 hours of sleep. I don't know whether in our eyes, in society's eyes, they are of the same thing.
Well, you know, what we do know, I mean, what this headline in NST suggests about paying bus drivers more is that bus drivers were taking on more work, you know,
to get more money. Yeah.
Because they're underpaid and therefore they took more trips than was, in fact, advisable. But companies, you know, if they're using the same bus driver, will know whether a bus driver is driving far more than they should, right? And I think that's should be legal. I mean, it should be a legal requirement that bus drivers not be taking more jobs than they can handle, because the outcome is so clear. Yeah. I mean, we've always blamed, you know, it on, you know, bus drivers with a
reckless
drug problem.
Yeah.
You know, that's so we had all that whole thing about testing drug bus drivers. But what about sleep? I mean, sleep seems to be as important as whether you're on substance or not.
Okay, it's 6:17 right now. We've got more discussion for you in just a few minutes right here on The Morning Run, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, the business station. The Way You Do by The Temptations there. Good morning. It's now 6:21 a.m. You're listening to The Morning Run with me, Melissa. Also, Sharad is here. And we're taking a look at this Twitter storm happening over the choice of naming their baby. Bollywood couple has come under criticism for naming their newborn baby boy after a 14th century conqueror. So many Indian Twitter users have criticized Kareena Kapoor and Saif Ali Khan for naming their son Taimur Ali Khan Pataudi. Many believe that Taimur is the conqueror who killed thousands in India during his conquest. Taimur, also known as Tamerlane in the West. Tamerlane. Have you heard of this conqueror?
Yes, of course. I wonder what, because, you know, kids in school will call this kid. I mean, he's like, they could call him Timur or Taimur, I guess. Why should people be concerned? I guess because, first of all, they're celebrities. And so everything celebrities do come under scrutiny. And I'm sure that they themselves were not unaware that their choice of names was going to be subject of some discussion. Have you ever watched Kareena Kapoor act in anything? Or Saif Khan.
Many, many years ago. I mean, I think she was back in the 90s and she was really kind of hot. I remember watching several movies. I can't remember the names of them. But she's familiar enough a face that I would recognize those dimples.
Yeah, she's actually, I've only ever watched her in something, and it was recently, it was a Salman Khan movie. I'd never watch movies like this because I never really liked Salman Khan. But it was called Baranji by or something. But it was a very clever film about communal divides in India, and with Salman Khan playing this kind of Hindu devotee who ends up, you know, looking after a little young Muslim girl and returning her to her family in Pakistan. And Kareena Kapoor mm-hmm. plays that role. So, I mean, you know, is this really a matter of public debate? I'm not sure.
Is it insensitive? That's the question. So yeah. People on Twitter have been saying, look, it's an insensitive thing.
If you call yourself Adolf.
Well, yeah, maybe.
Adolf is just a name. And until Adolf Hitler, you know...
Hitler, that's a bit more specific.
Well, Hitler would be the family name, wouldn't it?
But if you named your child Hitler, then that's insensitive.
Why? I mean, but the name is just the name. I mean, it doesn't...
So you think it's okay to...
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and so if you commemorate a particular... I mean, I think because... Perhaps, and I'm not sure about Indian society, but, you know, there will be all these sensitivities around the question of, you know, the so-called Muslim conquerors of India and the reign of the Mughals, because of the kind of rising self-consciousness of, you know, of sort of Hindu nationalist politics that tries to repudiate this long period of Muslim influence, in the subcontinent. So I think there's probably something in the mix going on there. If you remember, I believe it was Salman Khan who was attacked recently because of his position on Pakistani artists,
right.
Following that military skirmish or attack by terrorists on an army camp. Indian army camp, and you know, they were like, I think Salman Khan came out to say something like, oh, you know, Pakistani artists are Pakistani artists, they've got nothing to do with the politics of that country and they shouldn't be banned, and he was attacked. And I think there's been quite a bit of savaging of Muslim artists in India because of this kind of Hindu nationalist politics.
Well, speaking about that, another story.
I'm sure somebody's going to attack me for saying this, but anyway.
Well, look, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi over the weekend laid the foundation stone for what is said to be the world's tallest statue. It's projected to cost multi-million dollars in projects, but this project as well has sparked criticism and online Twitter debate as to whether India should have this world's tallest statue. It is going to be twice the height of the Statue of Liberty, twice the size of the Statue of Liberty, and five times higher than Christ the Redeemer in Rio de Janeiro.
Okay, Melissa, again, this goes back to Hindu nationalist politics. I mean, the person, who's this person that they're creating a statue is not Gandhi. It is a man called Patel, I believe, isn't it? And, you know, in 20th century Indian politics, Patel has a particular place.
Is it Chhatrapati Shivaji? It's a 17th century Hindu ruler.
Oh, is it? Oh,
yes.
It's not Patel.
No, it's not. It's of this 17th century Hindu ruler. It's drawn some brickbats because, you know, again, it's a cultural symbol, but yet I think not everyone agrees to it. And it comes back to at the end of the day when, you know, there's a decision to build something, should everyone agree with it? You know, if you disagree with it, is that okay, given that it is, you know, government money that's being used to spend to build this?
Yeah, well, okay, Melissa, okay, this is my understanding. So what I was referring to were yet other plans to build a 182-meter tall tribute to an Indian independence hero, Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel, in his home state of Gujarat. Gujarat is also the home state of...
Narendra Modi?
Yes, mm-hmm. But where he was chief minister, but also of Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi. So, you know, but Gandhi is not favored by Hindu nationalists. And of course, we know that it was Hindu extremists who murdered Gandhi. And so there's this kind of debate, I think, going on in India around Gandhi's legacy, especially Gandhi's position on the Muslim minorities and also the whole Pakistan issue, you know, where India was divided. And so they kind of have Patel as the kind of counterpoint and, you know, and in trying to fight the Gandhi legacy, as it were. And look, honestly, I don't know enough about this rather arcane debate that's going on in India today. But what I do know, it is this fueled by Hindu nationalism. I mean, we know that any kind of ethnic-based nationalism, even in here in Malaysia, produces this kind of discourse, right? Again, you know, who are the ethnic heroes, or the race heroes?
Yeah.
And, you know, and because it always begs the question, who are the enemies? And in, you know, often it's not external enemies, but internal enemies, right? So it is other people within the nation state.
I find the process of not just, you know, the historical and the cultural elements behind it, but just the simple act of building a statue to commemorate something. You know, in Islam, that's not done. You don't build a statue, figurines to commemorate something. But the idea of doing that, especially in the West, is really quite fascinating to me, where these statues end up. You know, for instance, the Statue of Liberty, Christ the Redeemer, they're all symbols, but also huge revenue generators in terms of tourism, because people want to go there and look at it. Whether or not that's something, I mean, how did we decide to want to revere these giant statues in civilization is really quite fascinating for me.
Yeah, also at the end of the day, looking at priorities in India, whether this is
how much is this going to cost? Billions of
530 million dollars. US dollars, which would be 2 billion Malaysian ringgit. Will it generate revenues for out of tourism? That to make sense of that?
Yeah.
I mean, is that what is really going on there? Is it about kickbacks, or is it about, you know, supplying, giving work to contractors? Is this a kind of, you know, pump priming the economy by creating statues?
Apparently, there's a petition online now urging the government to drop the plans. We've got the 6:30 news bulletin coming up next with Lynn Mark on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9 Kid by The Pretenders there. Hello and good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. It's coming up to 6:39 a.m. this Tuesday morning, the 27th of December. I'm Melissa Idris with Sharad Kutin. And we're here looking at some stories that have caught our attention. I saw over the weekend, Sharad, I caught a tweet of yours. I follow you religiously on Twitter.
Oh, you flatter me.
I saw a tweet that you had that caught my attention, made me chuckle a little bit. You pointed out that there was a school in PJ that had a warning sign warning parents that they could be denied entry into school grounds if they weren't wearing the appropriate attire. So there was a dress code, essentially, to say what parents should be wearing.
Yeah, and, you know, and the graphics described, you know, the appropriate dress. And, you know, it could be a pantsuit, it could be a balaclava, whatever.
If I could just elaborate on that. So on the appropriate, the left-hand side with the tick, that means approved attire, was a pantsuit a la Hillary Clinton. There was also, you know, covered woman in hijab. And then with the men, there was also, I think, a dress, office wear.
On the
right side with the giant red axe, there was a woman who clearly looked like she had come back from a night out on the town. You know, she's in clubbing attire, and the man in t-shirt and shorts and slippers. Now, again, those are two extremes of what they I would consider a dress code, right?
Yeah.
But still, what do you think about the idea of the school imposing a dress code?
Yeah, I didn't look, I mean, just to say, I couldn't really say that it was party attire that the woman was wearing. I mean,
I made a mental note as I was thinking, the dress is nice, you know, I don't think
but
any
the hemline's
parent,
pretty high.
The hemline was quite high. Short.
Yeah. So, okay, so the question is, you know, is this even legal for schools to do? Can they deny access
to a parent?
To a parent based on what the parent is dressing, you know, dressed in, and have schools created bylaws in which they make these rules? And then the question is, what restrains schools in terms of making laws? Could they just make it up? I don't like your haircut or whatever.
Right.
So, I mean, I know that the argument, and we say, well, Sharad, you're being unreasonable. All they're suggesting is modesty, blah, blah, blah. And those are the arguments that trotted out over and over again for these little, you know, Napoleons, right, as I like to call them, to impose their standards, their morality on others.
I had a... a thought that crossed my mind was they use the extreme case of this woman with a really short skirt and, you know, a skimpy dress, shall we say, as an example of inappropriate attire. But I'm just wondering, is it because it looked like she had come back from a night out on the town? What if it was that same hemline, but it was someone who had just come back from the gym or running on a track, you know, wearing shorts? Or
I don't think, I mean, nothing in the dress code suggests the context in which you're wearing clothes and whether these are work clothes for you.
So is it just the hemline that they're concerned about?
I don't know. I don't know what's going through the minds of the school, but they seem to have in it, in their thinking, that it's their right to impose such rules. I mean, I think that's one thing that I would contest. And because when I put it out on Twitter, immediately I knew that, you know, I mean, first of all, why should I even be surprised? I mean, schools would not be the first to impose such dress codes. We have all kinds of other government institutions where, issues of dressing have become, a basis for denying people services. I mean, and then because I kind of cheekily said, maybe, you know, the schools and the ministry shouldn't be able to impose such rules until they get their, their scores on, up.
I thought that was very
funny. Unless until they achieve educational excellence, they shouldn't be allowed to, to conduct any kind of moral policing. Because it seems to me, I mean, I said that in a kind of tongue in cheek, because I think that priorities are completely skewed, in this country when it comes to these kinds of things. You see that the fixation on people's dress rather than the fixation on pedagogical issues. I mean, I don't know how obsessed teachers and headmasters are about, whether they will put signs up to encourage, make sure, if you don't read a book to your child a week, you will be denied access to the school. Or if, you switch off that home entertainment system and, do your schoolwork with your children, you'll be denied access to the school. I mean, all these things that perhaps matter far more than the dress, and the things
let's look at it from all angles. There are institutions that that impose dress codes. I'm just thinking of fancy restaurants or the orchestra. The Philharmonic Orchestra has a dress code. It's just simply to respect the place that you're going to. So perhaps this is just merely symbolic in its respect.
Well, I think the thing about restaurants, of course, is that they're private institutions, right? I mean, they're private, public, in a way that there is a sort of blurring of the lines. But I think it's very different from public institutions like hospitals. Would you deny somebody, as we've had before, denied somebody service coming into a hospital and say, well, your skirt's too short to serve you at this hospital? Would that be acceptable? I mean, what is the purpose of that institution? I think that should be the focus of our discussion. If you're a school and your work is in education, what business do you have in imposing rules of dress? Unless you can say that the kind of dress that parents wear will be disruptive to your functioning as an educational institution, or your functioning.
Could it be disruptive?
Well, I mean, I think the thing is, if you find parents a little too sexy or overexposed, then avert your eyes. I mean, what else is there to do?
Okay, but can you avert all the children's eyes?
Oh, I don't think the problem is children.
Oh, really?
I mean, I think it's the other adults, that. I mean, it's not children are not imposing these codes.
This was a Sekolah Kebangsaan. Was this a primary school or a secondary school?
Primary school.
It's a primary school.
I do think, though, Melissa, this has become a very curious kind of part of our culture, right?
The dress code.
Imposing our values on other people. I think it's just become part of our DNA. It's very much part of the authoritarian political culture that we have, and it's just extending to issues of society and culture. So we say, well, we make students wear uniforms. Why should we oppose? Improved scores?
No. I really like your suggestion. Make sure that your scores are higher in terms of your education scores, then you can impose your moral views.
Yeah, of course, I don't necessarily believe that. I don't think people should have the right, even
tongue
if they get good scores. But again, over and over again, we see this happening in the country, and it drives me batty when I see this. And now, because I was walking to the laundry when I saw this and I took a photograph and I tweeted it out because I hadn't seen that before and I was quite surprised.
You thought it was new.
Is this a new sign? And I don't pay attention to the primary school very much, but to the extent that I keep passing, you know, by its front gates, I was thinking, you know, that this again is the you know, and its power, because its power to exclude. And it seems to be that so many of our institutions, so many of our public spaces have that capacity. In the park next to the apartment where I live, it's a beautiful little park. I mean, annoyingly, a lot of people dump things in it, but never mind. I mean, that's the other
problem.
That's
another matter.
That's the public, and that's another issue. But there's also these signs that say you can't kiss in the park. And I'm thinking, what's wrong with kissing? And, you know, again...
Oh, you can't kiss in the park.
Yeah, apparently. This is the law that
how park... How is that sign like? So a big X, two people kissing.
Yeah, two people kissing. You know, a person with long hair and a person with short hair.
We don't like public affection in this country, clearly.
Well, I think some people don't like shows, you know, displays of public affection. But, you know, if it's not disruptive, I don't see, you know, and it'll be like, okay, we can't kiss and you can't hold hands. I mean, where does it stop, right? And who gave these authorities the power to regulate personal behavior to that extent? Yes, I believe that, you know, people shouldn't be drinking alcohol and breaking beer bottles.
Maybe
in parks.
There'll be signs that says you can't break wind in public. You know, personal behavior.
And I would like to see the people regulating it, you know, scrutinizing things like that. But it's okay. So we have some people tweeting in. Oh, Dr. Fu is. So it says there. He says no dress code for patients, maybe for visitors. But you know, how would you work that, Dr. Fu? I mean, it's somebody bringing in somebody who is going to be a patient.
Right.
You know, I mean,
it was an emergency. They had just come back from somewhere.
Again, you know, it is the focus on the most. Unimportant things ultimately. You know, I think there is something in the psychology of authoritarian societies. I mean, societies that love authoritarian rule and, you know, give up their powers to, you know, big men and the party. I mean, it's very typical of them to love uniforms. They love uniformity. I think, you know, there's good evidence to show that it's really part of what they call mass society, you know, fascist political arrangements, all about that. I mean, they want to create the distance between those in authority and those being governed has to be as far as possible. They don't like intermediate organizations.
But, you know, I think that's a generalization, right? I mean, when you boil down to it, personal behavior is something that you shouldn't be governing, you shouldn't impose your moral code on anyone else. But you do need some rules that I think the blurring of that line is where, let's use Singapore as an example, where you get fined for everything, right? But it works because
not
people
for everything. Well, I don't know if it works. I mean, Catherine Lim, you know, she's a short story writer, cultural figure in Singapore. She had this wonderfully satirical story about how Singaporeans, and this is just based on observation, that as soon as they cross the border, they start littering, because that's Johor Bahru, my hometown. You know, it's... You know,
because they won't be fined.
It didn't change behavior.
Right.
All it did was to impose such heavy sanctions that people say, okay, we won't do it now. But their commitment to what is going on, it's like you can sanction children, right? You can beat them black and blue and they will obey you. But do they really understand? And isn't it better to have a society based on understanding, including an understanding of our individual rights, you know, which I think often get erased in this rush to, you know, uniformity and compliance with law and order.
Well, tell us what you think. We've got our Twitter line open. So it's you can tweet us at BFM Radio, hashtag TellBFM, or text us at 016-201-9000, or also we're on WhatsApp, so you can always message us there. 6:50 right now, and as you may have heard, George Michael has passed away over the Christmas weekend. Here's our tribute to the pop star Freedom by George Michael on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.